Well, I'm Harold J. Butcher. The J stands for John, except I rarely ever use it. Never, as a matter of fact, use it in my signature. I was born in Ogden, Utah on May 17th, 1906, which makes me 76 years of age as of last May 17th. I went to public schools in Ogden, my hometown. I attended Weber College for 2 years in Ogden without any special effort toward preparing for anything particular. However, I became a member of the Young Democratic Clubs of Utah, and Senator King was our senator, William H. King, and he told me if I wanted to come to Washington, he'd find a position for me. He did, and I went to Washington, D.C. The position he found for me was not to my liking, particularly it was running an elevator in the Senate office building. His particular elevator that was assigned to his office. But that job didn't last long because he was working on a better job for me, and I had acquired skills as a typist and stenographer in business college, where I went as a special to specially prepare for this coming appointment that he had promised me. And I went into a legal position in the Interior Department, not a legal position as such, but a secretary to a lawyer. And he urged me to go to law school, and I did. I went to law school called Southeastern University. It was near my home and easily accessible, and I had to work because I had a wife and a child. And I went to school as early as 7 o'clock in the morning until 9, and then at 4 in the afternoon I would report back at the school and go until 8 and 9 o'clock, depending on the classes that I was interested in and the time area that was allotted to my studies. I went to that college for 3 years and graduated. I didn't take my degree, although a degree was eligible, was available for me, except one of my high school credits that had a deficiency in it, in algebra. And before I could arrange to get the defect cured, I had been offered a job in San Francisco with the National Park Service in a legal capacity, and I went there, and somehow or other the procurement of the degree became something that I was going to do in the future, and I never got around to doing. But I got a certificate of graduation, and except for this deficiency, which prevented my taking the degree, I didn't get the degree. That's of no great importance anyway.
Did you take the bar exam in California?
No, I didn't. That's a story in and of itself, but I won't go into that because it's no matter to Alaskans. This finger. I was going to take it on the typewriter. Mm-hmm. Weekend before I was to take the examination, I went to Big Sur National Park. Do you know where Big Sur is? Mm-hmm. Down the coast below Carmel. And I and a fellow was carrying a log across the stream to sit on. And I slipped and I hung onto the log and it hit a rock and broke my finger. And the bar examination was starting Monday morning, and here I was. I couldn't ride. I had this in a splint sticking out about so far and tied to my elbow, and I couldn't neither write nor type. I was going to take it on typewriter. Well, that's of no great importance. But that's why I didn't take the California bar. And meantime, I was employed by the Public Roads Administration as a procurement officer. They started out in Seattle, and they were going to move to Edmonton, and I was going to be the chief procurement officer in Edmonton, which I became. And it was while I was there that I heard about Anchorage and heard about everybody being newcomers in Anchorage, new people. And I thought, if I'm going to practice law, I can't go back to Ogden, Utah, where I'll have to become associated with a firm and take a menial position, or San Francisco, likewise, or Seattle. So I thought Anchorage is the place for me, and I opened up a law office, and within 6 weeks I had made more than my salary and was on my way. So that's how it brought me here.
Did anybody encourage you to go to Anchorage?
No, my own decision.
Did you know anybody in Anchorage?
Knew no one.
How did your family feel about moving to Anchorage?
They were willing. We all came up on a boat to Juneau, and then from Juneau flew over here.
What was Anchorage like when you first got here?
Well, 4th Avenue was nothing but a big mud hole from end to end, and false fronts on all the stores. Some of them were attractive, but most of them were, if you go down the alleys, were shacks. But they had the problems too. And
what year was this?
This was 1943.
What were the major businesses?
Oh, the Alaska Railroad, and the Alaska Railroad was the biggest business, and the FAA. FAA, I'm going to translate it for you. Federal Aviation
Administration,
yes. And the post office, and small businesses everywhere. Some very nice ones and some very attractive false fronts, as I indicated. But you had to go down the alley to see the nature of them. Bob Atwood was editor of the Anchorage Times. There was only one paper. Anchorage News started up later under the editorship of a man named Brown, Norman Brown. That was 3 or 4 years later. And that's still being published.
Did you join any clubs when you came?
Well, I joined the Elks Club. But that isn't what you meant, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I joined the Elks Club. And I've long since been a lifetime member.
Did you join any Democratic clubs? Become active in the
party? I joined the Anchorage Democratic Club and was active for a time, until I got read out of the party for conduct unbecoming a good Democrat. I criticized the governor of Alaska, whose name was Greening, and criticism of Governor Greening was not allowable. And so Stan McCutcheon and a couple of his henchmen read me out of the party. I didn't recognize their reading me out of the party because they had no authority to do that, and so I continued active for some time afterwards, but I was a conservative by nature, and eventually I've never joined the Republican Party either, but I voted Republican, for what it's worth. Now,
what was your first practice when you came to Anchorage? What did you do?
I just opened a law office and put my name on the on a sign out in front, and waited for business, and it came immediately.
Did you take a bar exam?
Oh yes, I took the bar examination in Juneau. Mm-hmm. That was in 1943.
What was it like?
Well, I was the only one I ever took, so I couldn't tell you what it was like in comparison with others, but I passed it.
Mm-hmm. It was a written exam?
It was a written exam, yes. It was a three-day examination. It had its humorous attributes, and it had some small problems. And you've taken a bar examination, have you? You're a member of the Alaska Bar? Okay, I'll tell you this little story then. Henry Roden was the Attorney General, and the Attorney General's in charge of the bar, as Jerry Williams was in charge of the bar during all the years he was Attorney General. I'm taking the bar examination. I'm the only one taking the examination. No, there's another guy taking it. He ran a collection agency in the city of Juneau. He was not trained as a lawyer at all. He hadn't been to law school. But he thought he'd take the bar. And he and I were taking it together, and in Henry Roden's office. And of course, I would go up at 8 o'clock in the morning and go till noon, and then start again at 1 and go all afternoon. And sometimes Henry worked late, and sometimes he didn't. But he had a full law library there in the Attorney General's office. And he'd say, well, I'm going. Got to go home and have my dinner. And I'd say, well, are you going to leave me here? And he'd say, yes, I trust you. But you won't look up all the answers in the book. And I kept my word. I didn't use his library. But anyway, one afternoon, the second or third afternoon, I'm busily typing away, and there's a question about a minor and whether a minor is responsible for his negotiable instruments and promissory note. And I weigh it in my mind. Now, I know the rule about minors. They're not responsible for their contracts. But is a negotiable instrument an exception to the rule? And I stop and I think, and Henry says, what's the matter, are you stuck? And this is the Attorney General. And I said, yes, I am. And he said, well, what question are you stuck on? And I said, well, I've got this question involving a minor and a negotiable instrument. And he said, well, what can't you answer? And I said, well, I don't know whether a negotiable instrument is an exception to the rule. And he says, there are no exceptions. Thanks. I answered the question. But that's how informal it was.
Yeah, that's incredible. Did you ever have an oral exam at all?
No. No. Oh, well, yes, I guess I did. Judge Alexander was the judge who admitted me, and I think he asked me what law was, and I told him what I thought it was. And that was it.
When you got to Anchorage, did you find out your results right away from this bar exam?
Almost immediately. Seems to me I stayed in Juneau until I found out. I think I stayed in Juneau until I found out. Yeah, I was admitted in Juneau, that's right. I was admitted.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to stay there. I mean, I didn't have to stay there, but I did stay there. What I meant was I had to have stayed there in order to be admitted in Juneau.
When you got to Anchorage, what kind of people came to you for legal help?
Well, I can't say exactly what kind of people. I can't remember half of them now, but...
Were your first clients?
People came in with real estate problems with, I don't remember doing a corporation the first week or two, but I did a lot of deeds, a lot of contracts, a lot of leases, mortgages, and I remember calling up Warren Cuddy one time and saying, Mr. Cuddy, there's a guy in my office who wants me to make a deed for him, and it's called, he calls it a deed by the entirety, and I said, have you got a form that would indicate what a deed by the entirety is like, how it's composed? And he said, oh, hell, Harold, don't draw deeds like that. He said, well, you cheat yourself out of a probate fee someday by drawing a deed like that because the wife automatically takes. And I said, thanks, and I called John Manders and asked John if he had such a deed, and he says, yes, I'll bring one down. And I said, no, I'll come up and get it. He said, no, I'll bring it down. Brought the deed down to my office, and I knew what a deed by the entirety was. I mean, that...
Were there forms?
There were forms, but I didn't have one. And as a matter of fact, I'd never heard of a deed by the entirety. That was strictly a... Well, not strictly Alaskan, but it was a Western States type of conveyancing where you convey to husband and wife and they, it's in the entirety and the survivor takes.
Mm-hmm. What were fees like? What were your fees like?
Well, $15 for a real estate contract, $10 for a deed in those days. And other papers. Mortgages a bit more, and leases about $25. I'm just guessing now.
There was a minimum fee schedule.
There was a minimum fee schedule.
Did you follow it pretty much?
Yes, I did. I rarely ever departed from it.
Was it common practice to follow?
Yes, it was.
Do you know who made up the minimum fee schedule?
Well, the bar, it was adopted at the Bar Association, and I became secretary within a month or two after my arrival here, secretary and treasurer of the bar, and from then on I consulted Grigsby and other members of the bar as to whether we should change the fees or continue them, and I had a copy of an old fee schedule that I had inherited when I took the job on, and and we'd maybe every 6 months or once a year, at least once a year, we would discuss the fees and increase them slightly, not tremendously, but slightly.
Mm-hmm. Did you use any other bars as points of comparison?
I think we had copies of the Fairbanks Bar Association fee schedule and the Juneau fee schedule, perhaps the Ketchikan. I can't remember seeing them now individually as such, but I'm sure we had them available. And our fee for a divorce was $50, and I think shortly after I took on the job of secretary, we increased it to $150. That was the going rate for a long time.
Mm-hmm. It's a large increase.
Yeah.
Why such a...
Well, I don't know why. I can't remember the discussion. It's too long ago.
Were there any kind of cases you wouldn't handle?
Well, I wouldn't handle trivial cases. You ask me that question, I'll give you an answer. Mm-hmm. A fellow came in one day and said that he was walking along a road somewhere just out of Anchorage, and out of Anchorage then was just, you might say, out on the park or someplace not too far away, and he said a woman came driving by in a car, and he stood to one side, and she hit his hand, and he showed me a bruise on his hand, and he said he wanted to sue her, and I said, how much do you want to sue her for? And he said, I want to sue her for $25,000, and I said, well, you better go somewhere else, because I am not going to entertain a suit or bring a suit for any amount like that for an injury like you've got. And he said, well, it hurts. I said, well, I'm sorry, but can't take the case. But another attorney did take it. I won't mention who it was, but I think he sued for $25,000. He got $5,000 or something.
Was there any kind of specialization in practices? Were there certain lawyers you knew to go to for certain...
Well, most of the lawyers in town had a general practice. They had to have a general practice in order to survive. Davis and Renfrew did some abstract work. They were the abstract specialists, I suppose. Bill Renfrew wasn't. He was a very good criminal lawyer. Mm-hmm. But Davis was a scholarly type and a thorough research man, and he enjoyed that kind of work. And so he did the abstract work for the firm. Warren Cuddy did the bank type of business, trusts and mortgages, particularly mortgages and probate. Everybody did probate. McCary's wife was his secretary, and she was a very good, conscientious clerk or secretary, and she learned the probate procedure, and she could prepare all the papers that were necessary for a thorough probate hearing and finalizing of the probate. He did a good deal of probate, but so did Davis and Renfrew. Question?
What about construction work? Was there...
There wasn't a lot of construction work, although there was some. But by this time, I had got acquainted with some labor unions, and they thought I was okay, and they retained me. And as I indicated, I represented the plumbers' union, the electrical workers' union, all the railroad unions, and iron workers' union. I never represented the laborers' union as such.
Who did?
Can't remember. I don't know whether they had an attorney.
Did people have outside counsel?
There weren't many attorneys coming up who needed to be admitted for a particular case or so. I can't remember for the first few years hardly anyone who came up under that kind of arrangement. Later on, when construction began to develop, lots of army contracts and lots of local buildings going up, then outside counsel began to appear. Many of the contractors were out of Seattle or Portland, and attorneys whom they had retained for many years in those places came up and represented them in certain cases, but usually they used the local attorneys because they felt they knew the local problems better.
What about the juries? What were they like? Could you take cases that you wouldn't have much of a chance of today and find the juries were sympathetic or weren't sympathetic?
Well, it depends on the kind of case. I suppose. A woman who shot her husband asked me to represent her, and and I recommended that we seek a jury. I felt that she, being a woman, and might get some women on the jury who'd be sympathetic to her particular problem. Her husband was kind of a two-timer. And and that was a mistake. I was told later by Grigsby himself that there's certain kinds of people I shouldn't have on juries, and if a woman is the defendant, that I ought to get rid of all the women, because women are not, don't look kindly upon their sister's crimes. And I had a jury of maybe 8 women and 4 men. But anyway, she was found guilty. But she didn't serve long. She served 9 months, I believe. Well, what's the, you're not familiar with California, are you? You're from the East Coast?
From the Midwest.
Midwest. Terminal Island is a woman's prison, a woman's federal prison in Los Angeles Harbor. And that's on an island, Terminal Island. And she was confined there for 1 year. That was her total sentence. The judge had sympathy for her problem, whether the jury did or not. And she got 3 months off for good behavior and served 9 months. And I visited her while she was in prison. And was a rather amusing thing, walking around her accountant and I arrived. She owned a trailer court out here, rather substantial trailer court, and her husband had come in the night before she shot him and insisted that she sign a power of attorney giving him full authority to operate the trailer court, and he was going to give her $500 and send her back to where she came from, which was Cleveland, Ohio, and to hell with you. And she thought it over during the night, and she had a pistol, and when he came into her room the next morning, she killed him. And she shot him, and I've always believed that if she, as he staggered down the hallway with his back to her, she put 3 or 4 more bullets in his back, and had she not done that, I think I might have got her off, because his conduct was deplorable. Flaunting other women right in her own, on her own property and in her own office building, and but it was those four or five other shots that did the trick. But anyway, I shouldn't be telling you this, so you got me. I haven't mentioned her name, have I? But anyway, she was sentenced to serve 1 year, and I had to see her because I was handling the trailer court for her. She and myself and her accountant, and we had to go down and see her. And we went in this terminal island, and there were girls in striped skirts and uniforms walking around the lawns who had been confined there. And in came this woman, and she was dressed like any other secretary in the place. She had a little sweater on and dressed neatly in a little short skirt and stockings and shoes, high-heeled shoes. And I said, "Well, how come?" She said, "Well, they discovered that I had a degree from a university, and that I had taught English and speech and deportment, and they immediately made me a teacher, and I'm teaching these girls, and that's why they allow me to dress like this." So she had a song, really.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was a federal prison, woman's prison.
Was that Judge Diamond that was before Elizabeth Helms?
No, that was Judge Cooper. Judge Cooper, they had formed a state bar by this time, and the statehood had been signed, the Statehood Act had been signed by Eisenhower and President Eisenhower, and we were a state, and that was the first corps of judges. And Cooper was one of that first corps. And but he wasn't the judge who sentenced her. Judge Davis sentenced her. Judge Cooper tried the case, and then he got sick, and Judge Davis took over his duty and sentenced her. Cooper would have given her 15 or 20 years, but not Davis. Davis gave her a year. But he understood the problem.
In the 1940s, what kind of work were most, they were all doing just a general practice?
They were all doing general practice.
But were they making money?
Well, I think so. I had no lack of income. The first month I was in practice, I made $1,200. Took it in cash. Besides that, I filed a number of cases in which the fee was based on a speculative. If I won, I got 33%. And if I didn't win, I got nothing. And I had a number of cases filed, and but I took in $1,200 the first month.
So people were doing fine.
Yeah.
What about the women lawyers? Was Dorothy
Tyner? Well, there were no women lawyers. Dorothy Tyner was working for the OPA.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no other woman lawyer. Dorothy Oz was down in Cordova as a magistrate.
Mm-hmm.
Or U.S. Commissioner, same as the magistrate.
Dorothy Oz was a commissioner in Cordova.
I think it was Cordova, yes.
Yeah. When women did start coming up, was there any problem? Were they able to get...
Oh, I think so. Stan Wilson got married somewhere in South Carolina, and he and his wife took the bar examination at the same time. This is about 47, 48. Maybe it was 50, I don't remember. And she was the first woman practitioner as such that came into Anchorage, and she was rather good, although she didn't get any very profitable cases. She did a lot of business law, the types of things that I did, as I mentioned right at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I should mention that I couldn't afford to hire a secretary when I started out, and I'd talk to people all day long, and I'd promise them their instruments, and then I'd sit up half the night typing the deeds and the contracts and the mortgages and the leases and or whatever. And sometimes come home at midnight, and sometimes even later.
Did most lawyers in that position?
No, I think I perhaps might have been the only one, but that was just during those first few months,
mm-hmm.
Until I could afford to hire a secretary. But I did my own work for a long time. Well, several months.
Mm-hmm.
It was a long time to me.
Tell me about George Grigsby at this time. What was he like when you... When did you first meet him? That sort of thing.
Well, I met him, I guess, in court. I heard that there was a very good criminal case coming up, and I went to court to hear what was supposed to be the master criminal lawyer in the state, who was preeminently George Grigsby. And he was representing a man who had run over a person and had something to drink. Can't remember the name of the case. Doesn't matter anyway. Too long ago. Everybody's dead now, including the defense attorney. But it was a case in which there was a lot of fireworks going on, and I attended it. Couldn't stay there all the time, but I would drop in and out whenever I could get a break from my office. And I learned some things. Strictly was a great teacher. And after I was elected secretary of the bar, Grigsby and I, as I indicated, became firm friends, and for a period of several years, we had lunch today, every day, and told me his stories, and they were tremendous and involved, and we formed quite a good friendship.
Do you remember any of the stories?
Yes, I remember many of them.
Can you tell me some of them?
Well, I can tell you some of them. You might not see the humor in them, but I saw the humor in them, and I'm sure you would. But first story he told me was he was representing a man accused of... he wasn't representing him yet. He was going to represent him, and he did represent him later. But he got a call one night at his home from a man and said, this George Grigsby? And he said, yes, this is George Grigsby. And he said, well, this is... And he named himself, and... He said, you know me, I've been in your office. And George said, well, I don't know you from your name, but he said, I've probably met you, and what's your problem? He said, well, I've got a serious problem, George. And George said, well, what is it? And he said, well, I'm going to come to that in a minute, but I want to identify myself. And George said, well, forget the identity. What's your problem? And he said, well, I'll get to it in just a minute. And George said, well, it's 10 o'clock at night, and I'm... about to go to bed, and he said, I don't want to get yanked out of here tonight. But what is your problem? And the guy said, well, I'm going to come to that in just a second. And George said, well, I insist right now on you telling me what your problem is, and I'm not going to talk to you unless you do. And the fellow said, George, you'll be surprised to hear this, but he said, I got a trunk in my room here in the hotel, and he said, there's a dead woman in that trunk. Well, that's the funny part about it. This guy kept... He was unable to tell George what his problem was, but he finally got it out. But that, to me, was a very funny story.
Did you ever find out who he was? Ever identify himself?
Oh, yes. George represented him, and he was convicted. But after all, when you've got a dead woman in your trunk and your hotel room, what are you going to do? It was the guy's wife.
What other one?
Well, there's the story of the... that George tells as it happened in Nome. A man was being prosecuted for, crime where you deface somebody's body in a...
Mayhem.
And, this fellow was accused of biting his opponent's... There was a fight on the barroom floor, and he was accused of biting his opponent's ear off. And George was defending, according to his story. This was around 1901 in Nome. George was examining the witness who... was testifying on behalf of the defendant, and George pressed him a little too hard, and he says, well, you say that this defendant, this man sitting here, bit the ear off the plaintiff? And the fellow said, yes, he did. And he said, did you actually see him bite his ear off? And he says, no, I didn't see him actually bite the ear off, but he said, I saw him spit it out. Well, let me... am I still on the tape? Can I get off the tape? How do I get off? He, in my opinion, was Alaska's finest lawyer. Not with respect to preparation. Although he was a great reader of cases when he had an important trial, he just had a natural affinity for the practice of law, and he could, sometimes I would assist him, and I would go in, he'd say, look up a certain series of cases answering this kind of, on this kind of problem. And I'd go in and lay out a bunch of books, and he would come in and say, the stuff is in these books, and I'd say yes, and he'd just glance quickly down a couple of columns and say, no, that's not it. No, that's not it. Oh, here's what I want. And just instantly recognize important cases. Sometimes it would be the judge who was rendering the decision, sometimes the Court of Appeals that was handling the decision. But he, all this stuff was in the back of his head, and he was just a master. And his ability in the courtroom was just beyond belief. He and I tried to, we represented two defendants. He represented a man named White, and I represented a man named McKenna. And McKenna is still living here in Anchorage, and I don't know what's happened to White, but White wanted me to represent him too, and I said, no, this problem's just too involved. And I said, I suggest you go see George Grigsby. He went to Grigsby, and Grigsby asked for a retainer fee, and he paid him, here I'm involved with names again, and I'm forgetting what I'm doing. White and McKenna lived in a court where there was a bunch of small shacky houses, and most of the residents were black. And White and McKenna had some problems with the black residents that were who had access to the free access to the water system. There's only one spigot in the center of this court, and where everybody drew their water, and they'd go down with buckets. And I think they might have laid a trap for this particular black person, but. White walks out of the house, out the front door of his little house, and walks down towards the spigot. McKenna goes around the back of the houses, and White gets down there, and he gets in an immediate fight with this black man, and he starts to beat him over the head with a bucket. And just at this moment, McKenna appears on the scene and shoots the black man in the leg. Of course, they're charged with assault with a dangerous weapon, the bucket and the gun. And we're in front of the jury, and here's this bucket. Ray Plummer was the district attorney, and the bucket couldn't have been mangled to the degree that it was without having been run over by a truck or a tractor. It was just mutilated beyond belief, just crushed, and all the in a mass, but the bail was still hanging on it, and it couldn't have been used to hit this man on the head. What they did was, in my opinion, was, and George's too, was that after the bucket was dropped, they came in with the car and ran over it two or three times. And George has got this bucket in his hand, he's standing in front of the jury, and he would say, well, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I'm looking at this bucket. And if this was a battle between this bucket, and he pointed to the black man, and he said, and whatever his name was, his head, he'd say, I would say that the bucket got the worst of it. I mean, those things just sprang spontaneously to him. I mean, great speaker, and just filled with wit. Now, that's a witty thing. The fight between the bucket and this man's head.
Did he get him off?
Well, he got them both off, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got them both off. They were acquitted. Then another attorney, Roger Cremo, brought a civil suit against them both. and we got them off the civil suit. The suit for $100,000 or something. Mm-hmm. So we got a double acquittal.
Did you do a lot of cases with Gracie?
Quite a few, yes.
Did you ever form a partnership?
No, then? No.
Why not?
Well, why not? George was not a moneymaker, and he had this secret drinking problem. And am I still on? You have to eliminate that.
I wanted to ask you how and why the integrated bar came about.
Well, it came about primarily because the local bar associations had no power and no legality. They were simply associations of lawyers who were doing a similar type of business and who wanted to be associated together, but they had no influence, they had no legislative enactment to support them, and there was discussion about it, and some of the, for instance, the Juneau Bar Association, I believe, sent an emissary up here, and the Ketchikan Bar did, and one of their chosen, and Fairbanks sent someone down, and we had a meeting here in town. I think I participated in that meeting, and it was decided that we would seek a legislative enactment giving certain powers to a legal fraternity or bar association. And that grew until the following year. We got a bill introduced into the legislature, and it was passed out with approval of the governor. I think we had passed the integrated bar before we became a state. I think two or three years before, or maybe as long as 5 years. That's vague in my mind. I know I was one of the persons that were seriously involved in the formation of the integrated bar. Judge Davis was really, or he wasn't a judge then, Ed Davis, E.V. Davis as he's known, was the emissary from our group who met with the other groups and traveled to their cities and continued the discussions. And he was on the first board of governors when the bar was finally formed, and I wasn't among the first board of governors. I followed when there was a vacancy a couple of years later.
Who were some of the people who met before the bar was passed, the Integrated Act was passed?
Well, there'd be Clasby from Fairbanks. Who's the attorney who had the heart attack in Juneau last week?
Oh, Ziegler.
Ziegler. Ziegler was one. Or his father. His father was a lawyer, and I don't know which of the Zieglers. I think it was perhaps the father. And myself and Grigsby and Davis here.
Who from Juneau?
I think Boochiever. And another man whose name I can't recall at the moment.
Was it Monagle?
Yes, Monagle. Yes, Mike Monagle. Yes. I can see that you've talked to others and you've got these names at your fingertips, but it was Mike Monagle. And it seems to me that an attorney in general by the name of Robertson had something to do with it.
Where did you all meet? In Anchorage?
We met in Davis's office. I think we met in Grigsby's office. That is when we met here.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being with with Ed Davis and Boo Cheever and somebody from Ketchikan in, I believe in, Boo Cheever was with a firm in Juneau, and I can't remember the head of that firm.
Faulkner?
Faulkner, yes, Faulkner. In Faulkner's office, or that is not his private office, in Boo Cheever's division of that office.
Was there anybody else from Ketchikan there besides Ziegler? Was Bill Stump there?
I believe Bill Stump was there.
Were these just informal meetings? Or?
They were informal to start with because we were seeking to get legislation passed,
mm-hmm.
and putting pressure on various and sundry legislative representatives, senators. But then when they finally passed the act, I didn't go down and testify. I don't remember who did from here. I'm sure Grigsby didn't. Maybe Judge Davis, maybe Ed Davis did. You can't stop quit calling him a judge because he wasn't a judge in those days. But you know who I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, it got passed and we elected the first board of governors, and I was not on that first board, but I was on the second group and was secretary of the association. Cliff Groh, I think, was on one of the board of governors about that time. Oh, and there's an attorney from Fairbanks, a bald man, totally bald, like the...
Mike Stepovich?
No, not Mike Stepovich.
Not Warren Taylor?
No, a younger man than Warren. Bill somebody. Have you been around Fairbanks?
I haven't gotten to Fairbanks, no.
Totally bald.
You've hit my weakness, I don't know.
I should remember his name.
Bogus.
Yeah.
Like 21st.
Yeah, that was it. Was Bill Boggs. And then I think the first board of governors, and then the second group around was Groh and myself, and the terms were overlapping. It works the same way it does now. You're elected for 4 years, I think, and then your term carries over a couple of years beyond a couple of others on the board, and their terms expire, and then when your term expires, well, there's somebody been on the board for a couple of years, and John Diamond was on the board during part of the time that I was on the board.
Did you ever work on the admission?
I didn't work on admissions. As I explained to you, Calamarides was the executive secretary, and he got paid a salary. I didn't get a salary.
Mm-hmm.
But the salary was intended for his secretary. a woman. Because she did the work. Yes, her name was her last name was Benny, B-E-N-N-Y. Her husband's name was Francis Benny, and she was I knew her so well. I had a cabin next to mine at Kenai Lake. The names were they're two first names, Fran. The names were combined into the name of their cabin, Fran something.
Was it Mary?
No, not Fran Mary. It fit together nicely, the two names. Can't remember it.
Were there any problems when the bar started up, the integrated bar?
Well, there's this problem that developed in Nome, in which Harold Stringer got bounced off I guess that was the Judicial Council,
mm-hmm.
not the Board of Governors.
Did you go to that Nome meeting?
No, I don't think I went to that meeting. I went to a number of meetings in Nome, but not that one. Can't remember why, but it seems to me I had a case or something that kept me here.
Was there a lot of lobbying for people who should be members of the Judicial Council that lawyers wanted?
I don't think there was a lot of lobbying. Each area, Fairbanks, Anchorage, Ketchikan, Juneau, had their sessions and selected a man, and with exception of Stringer, I think they were all approved. But Stringer's nomination caused a big rumpus in the local bar, and
did the individual bars nominate the men?
Yes.
They did?
Yes. The bar associations and the Anchorage Bar Association would have voted to support a certain person.
Who did they vote to support? If it wasn't Stringer.
Well, they did vote to support Stringer. He got on. Well, no, wait a minute. No, the first integrated bar, meeting of the integrated bar was at Nome, and they just arbitrarily selected
mm-hmm.
their representatives, and that's how Stringer got on. And a few of us couldn't swallow Stringer. He was a personable fellow, a lover type, very handsome, but a damn poor attorney.
Led the fight to get Stringer
off? Well, several of us were involved in it, and I think Ray Plummer and Buell Nesbitt were the two leaders. That's just a guess.
Mm-hmm.
I know I got my two bits worth in somewhere along the line, and
replaced him? Did Ray Plummer replace
him? I think you asked me that before, and I thought at first he didn't, but I think now that he did.
Yeah. I'm going to move quickly to the court bar fight.
All right.
Switch gears, yeah.
What
precipitated it?
It was precipitated by a ruling of the Supreme Court, which I don't think they had any right to so rule, that the fee schedule of the Anchorage Bar could be disregarded. And that the treasury of the Anchorage Bar Association, or of the State Bar Association, which then was rather sizable. I might tell you how that came about, how we got such a harvest, somewhere around $30,000.
Oh, yeah.
The Ketchikan people refused to attend a Bar Association meeting in Anchorage because when they had the Bar Association meeting in Ketchikan, the Anchorage Bar, the Anchorage attorneys didn't go to Ketchikan. And they had been dilatory in respect to Juneau Bar conventions when they were held there and to some extent in Fairbanks. And yet all these other bars would come in mass to Anchorage, and they'd go in mass to Fairbanks and to Juneau and to Ketchikan. But the Bar Association here didn't participate to the extent they should have. And I was secretary of the Integrated Bar. It occurred to me that I had been a purchasing agent at one time, and we used to equalize freight rates all over the United States. If cement manufacturer in Pennsylvania was going to bid on a contract in California, say in a national park, it was in the National Park Service where I was employed, they would, in addition to the bid, they would, so much 100 pounds of cement, they would offer to equalize the freight rates so that by that equalization, everybody got a similar price, a competitive price by this equalization. So having had this experience, it occurred to me that, and I propounded this doctrine, and it was accepted, that the dues be raised to a sum sufficient to equalize the cost of travel from Fairbanks and Anchorage to Juneau or to Ketchikan, or from Ketchikan and Juneau up to Anchorage or to Fairbanks, so that everybody, and this fund would go into the Bar Association and be retained to defray the cost of coming to conventions, not the total cost, but the difference that would result. And I made this proposal as secretary of the Bar Association of the Integrated Bar, and it was accepted and voted on in Ketchikan. Mm-hmm. And the dues were raised from $50 a month to $100 a month. And as a result of this, there were several hundred lawyers in Alaska by this time, and the money poured in, and we had it around $29,000 or $30,000 in our bank account in Anchorage. And Buell seized the bank account under his authority as Chief Justice. He just did away with the Integrated Bar Association by an order. Didn't do away with it, but took their money and changed their fees and did everything he could do. And of course the attorneys were in an uproar all over the state, and here Talbot was employed, Dave Talbot, to prepare a complaint. And the bar was the Chief Justice, and the Supreme Court was sued by the attorneys of Alaska.
Did the Alaska Bar Association have a minimum fee schedule?
Yes.
They did.
Oh, no. Oh, wait a minute. I think so. Yes, they did. Yes, it did.
It did, and that was what the Supreme Court said could be disregarded?
Yeah, it was one of the things. The worst thing was that they seized the bank account, and they did that in the most peculiar way. Tom Stewart, who's been judge at Juneau for many years, Superior Court judge, at the behest of Buell, went down and demanded the money, and when it was refused him, he went back and reported it to Buell, and Buell called I don't know whether we still had U.S. Marshals, and I guess we did, called U.S. Marshal and ordered him to go over there with a gun and hold up the bank and take the money. I don't really mean literally hold it up, but Roger Cremo was the attorney for the bank, and he said that the only way they were going to get the money was to come down there with a gun, so they came down with a gun. Didn't flourish it, as I recall, but would have flourished it, but Roger, having been made, it been made known to him that the marshal had a gun. If it was a marshal, it might have been a state police officer. He told the clerk to give over the money. So they took around $29,000 or $30,000.
Over the time that you practiced and you were a judge, what kind of reputation can you have lawyers in the community have, or have lawyers have in the community?
Well, I think they had a pretty good reputation. Judge Forbes, who was an attorney from, or a judge from Fairbanks, a short-timer, first man to wear a robe in Alaska, after he was appointed, he came from North Dakota or South Dakota, was a political appointee by some powerful senator in Washington. Bailey Bell was a local attorney, was also from, he was from Oklahoma. He had got in some difficulty with the Bar Association and had been held in contempt. And well, what he did, they were trying a case, and he went across to the other table during a recess and took some papers off the table and put in his own briefcase. And this was the accusation. I wasn't present in court when it happened, but this is what caused him to be adjudged in an unethical status by the bar, and they had a trial. And Judge Forbes came down to try the case. McCary disqualified himself. Judge Forbes said, I'm going to exonerate Mr. Bell. He said, I find that the attorneys as a whole in Alaska are so horrendous in their practice, or words to that effect, those aren't his exact words, but their practice is so deplorable that I find that the conduct of Mr. Bell is not unethical. And I think that's where this low morale and low caliber of practitioners resulted from was that statement of his. Mm-hmm. And so he exonerated Bailey. But Bailey had actually gone over to the other table and taken a deed or something and put it in his own, which was going to be introduced in evidence, been marked and everything else.
So you don't think that they have that bad of reputation?
No, I think they normally had. Most of the men I can think of were pretty conscientious, mm-hmm, with respect to their treatment of their clients and with respect to their conduct in court and their relationship with each other.
Thank you.